On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center, I would like to turn the call over now to Ms. Annie Beigel.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and good morning, or afternoon, rather, to everybody. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, the New York State Smokers Quitline, I'd like to welcome all of you today to today's conference call, Cultural Competence and Tobacco Dependence. Our featured speaker, Dr. Jonathan Fader, Assistant Professor of Family Medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, is going to provide the presentation today. Just a quick reminder, on our last call in November, we mentioned the American Academy of Family Physicians and the American Academy of Pediatrics template for meaningful use in EHRs. They've put together a simple and easy-to-use template that will satisfy meaningful use objectives and measures for tobacco use cessation. This is something you may want to consider including in your EHR fields as our healthcare system evolves over the next several years with the strong emphasis on prevention of chronic disease and tobacco use being a major contributor. You may want to include these fields now if you are beginning to change over your systems rather than try to include them later. And these simple recommendations are posted on our website where you registered for the call and where you get the materials. It's under tools and it's titled Integrating Tobacco Cessation into Electronic Health Records. And now, getting to today's conference call, we're pleased to offer continuing education hours, including CME, CEU, OASAS, clock hours, and CRCE hours. Now, to fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we're required to disclose the following. Dr. Fader has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does he have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies, biomedical device manufacturers, and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. Now, to obtain the continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. And please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after January 14th. Now, that's a week from this Friday, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible so you can get your credit. And now it's my pleasure to turn the call over to you, Dr. Jonathan Fader. Dr. Fader?
Well, thank you so much, Annie. It's a pleasure to be back, and I want to thank you and Pat and the rest of the work group for inviting me back. And I'm delighted to be here talking about a topic that I consider to be of utmost importance in healthcare in general, but especially when we're talking about things specific to tobacco use, nicotine dependence, et cetera. So I'm going to... Before I start the talk, I just want to remind you that the disclosure that Annie made. And so if you start off your presentation, I'm now on slide 2, and I'm switching to the third slide of the objectives of what I hope to accomplish today. You know, what I want to talk about today is just getting everybody on the same page about what we mean when we say culturally competent. What that idea is. Essentially, I don't think you can become culturally competent. The goal here is really that we can enhance our ability to understand people's cultural background, and that cultural competence is a process. We're hoping in this call to, you know, to touch on the idea of how cultural background is important specific to smoking and how you can incorporate that into specific techniques and methods to use those methods to understand people's cultural background, how it relates to tobacco use and tobacco cessation. So if we move to the next slide, those of you that attended my talk on motivational interviewing know that I like to give my respect to theorists in the field. And Yoda, I think, is someone who said something very wise that applies to the idea of cultural competence. Yoda said, and I'm going to try out my Yoda impression here and see what people think. Named must be your fear before banish it you can. Well, regardless of how you feel about my Yoda impression, I hope that you'll appreciate this quote, because what I think this quote talks about, as related to what we're talking about, is the idea that cultural issues, things like prejudice, racism, things like people's cultural background is a very sensitive topic. Most people have a lot of apprehension. I do trainings for physicians and for nurses and respiratory therapists and about cultural competence. And I find that many people are worried about it, concerned about talking about it, fear of thinking that they're going to be perceived as ignorant. So you all have taken a wonderful step by attending this call because you're braving that. This is a sensitive topic. It's an area that people have a lot of reservations about. So, you know, I just wanted to name that fear and to congratulate all of you for attending this call and taking a step towards learning more about it, or if you already are someone who's somewhat expert, thinking about it in a new way, hopefully. Okay, so if we move to the next slide, what are we talking about when we say cultural competence? Well, I'm going to give you one definition that we're going to think about. Certainly, it's not the exhaustive definition of what cultural competence can be, but one idea is that we're hoping to understand information about an individual, in this case, usually a patient's, cultural background, to enhance how you interact with them. Now, specifically, to tobacco cessation, we're going to think about what questions you ask, and how you think about that person in terms of their cultural background in order to really enhance your ability to perhaps get them thinking about quitting smoking. Okay, if we move on to the next slide, I want you to put out that cigarette. Now, I don't know about you all, but I get very excited. I get very animated. I get into the idea of helping patients quit smoking. I'm guessing that a lot of you on this phone call also feel similarly about the urgency of helping someone release their connection to nicotine dependence, tobacco use, smoking, etc. We as a healthcare profession, whatever, regardless our specific discipline, we come from a culture that really says we want people to quit. Okay. It may so happen that the person we're talking to comes from a different cultural background, and that culture may be related to their ethnic background, their religious background, it could be related to their gender, it could be related to what we think of as socioeconomic status. And that could be a big barrier for them to come on board with our ideas about what they should do about their tobacco use. So part of this call is helping us to just think more about that. Think more about the fact that we might have diverging ideas, different ideas about what people think about smoking based on our culture. I'm just going to remind everybody to put *6 on their phone to mute because I'm hearing some sounds. I just want to make sure everybody can hear me clearly. So if you haven't hit *6, you should go ahead and do that if you wouldn't mind. Okay, so what we're doing here is we're talking about how we can understand that better. The other thing is it's very complicated. You know, if you move to the next slide, I saw this picture and I thought, my God, you know, there's so many different cultural, look at this, how confusing it is here. Not for the fact only that it's written in a different language, but this symbol is hard to even understand. Smoking means different things for different populations, just like any behavior, but here we're talking specifically about smoking. Smoking has a different meaning. There are different cultural norms, as we'll talk about soon, shortly. There's a different cultural idea about what smoking is, and the goal of this call is to help to elucidate that, to make that more clear with the way we talk to patients. Okay. A couple more points about the idea of cultural competence. If you move to the next slide, as I said before, I don't really believe in a thing as cultural competence. Right, I believe that cultural competence is not, that by the time you finish this phone call, I mean, I've been doing teaching and training and research on cultural competence for many years now, and what I find is that I don't feel myself to be culturally competent. There's many times where someone will point out something that I've said or the way I think about things, as hopefully someone will in the question period of this phone call. And I realize that there's a way that I can learn more about my misperceptions or my thoughts about a particular idea about someone's background. So the whole goal here is to respect that we're all at different stages of development. And what I hope for this call is that some of the questions, techniques, ideas that I present will be helpful to you to look at yourself and your practice in being more sensitive to people's cultural background. Okay. In the next slide, one of the issues around cultural applying cultural ideas to healthcare, whether it's tobacco cessation or another issue in healthcare, is that there are two ideas, stereotypes and generalizations, that come up in thinking about cultural beliefs, cultural background. The issue with stereotypes and generalizations is that, you know, one of the things that we need to do in order to be more aware of culture is to think about different cultural norms. That's what we call a generalization. So a generalization is something that we say, oh, you know, there are certain rates in a particular community, in a Native American population, higher rates of smoking in this area. Okay, it's best if we can have some data behind that, but also sometimes it's clinical experience that suggests that. That certain areas, maybe if I'm working, for example, in a certain group in a rural area, there may be higher rates of chew than there would be in an urban area. So, of smokeless tobacco. So one of the things that we're thinking about is generalizations and how they apply. We need to be aware of generalizations because they're useful to us in understanding cultural backgrounds. However, if we apply them blanketly, if I assume that just because I'm in a rural area, people will chew more, I may miss important things. So what we're trying to do is use cultural information to help us understand, but not overuse it so that we perpetuate what we call a stereotype. So that's a real balance in a clinical setting, to really take that into heart and to think about, okay, I've seen this before with a certain ethnic population or a certain age group or whatever, however we're defining, or a certain sexual orientation. So I'm wondering if this is happening here around smoking. However, not to generalize about it and assume that just because that person comes from a particular background, they necessarily have that habit around smoking. So just to give you some examples of generalizations, if you move to the next slide, you know, there are studies that have shown that for an African-American community, for African-American youth, that authoritarian parental messages, very strict parenting, can actually help protect against risky smoking behavior. So that doesn't mean that it's true with every African-American youth that you see, but it is something that's shown up in data to say that that is a pattern that could be protective. Also, Caucasian girls are more likely than African-American girls to think that smoking enhances their self-esteem. That's been shown in data, too. So that may be something that you could think about when you're talking about smoking with African-American versus Caucasian young women, about their self-esteem and how that may affect them. So that's an example, although again, yet again, we don't want to think just because you're talking to a young African-American young woman that smoking is not going to be associated with high self-esteem. If you move to the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about just some more cultural norms and research that has been done. There's been a fair amount of research that's starting to be done in the past decade about tobacco use in different cultural groups. And this has led to a report by the Surgeon General in 1998. A couple things that are there just to make clear that there are some disparities and some differences about the impacts of smoking, which I want you to be aware of. First of all, smoking is certainly a major cause of disease in minority groups, ethnic minority groups, African-American, Latino, Native Americans, and that African-Americans really bear, of those groups I mentioned, some of the biggest health burdens related to smoking. As far as high prevalences, American Indians and Native Alaskans show higher prevalences of tobacco use when compared to other groups. And African-American and South Asian men also have high prevalence when you look at smoking rates. Move to the next slide, some more information from that Surgeon General's report. Just to give you some background, African-American and Hispanic adolescents, that if you look at smoking prevalence, it increased after the 90s, after there was a decline. So it was on the increase again. And that, you know, we can't really say that there's one specific factor that really determines how smoking is going to happen with racial and ethnic groups. These are just some of the factors I'm mentioning, and that there's certainly more need for research. So that's one of the factors that you see out there. As I said, there has been some research, but there's not a ton of research, especially about cultural issues in smoking. So this call hopefully might generate some interest and some work towards some of the research that's been done that I've been involved in and that other people are doing around cultural issues in healthcare. Okay, just to give you some hard data, on the next slide, there's some data here from the CDC that just document in this table that there are differences around smoking. These are for adolescents. What you see is that there are certainly differences, as I mentioned before. There's a high rates, as you can see, it stands out. Native Americans and American Indians have very high prevalence of smoking. So clearly there are differences, just baseline differences in the prevalence of smoking. And so it's important to pay attention to those. And as I said before, it's a generalization that you can take into the room. And based on who you're meeting with, you might be even more curious about smoking habits, especially if you're not someone that's doing smoking cessation every single day, but it's part of your practice. Okay, and the next slide. These are people who are not adolescents, adults. You can see that there's still those differences still hold up, and they're pretty significant. As you can see, you know, by some of the data that's demonstrated here on this slide. Those healthcare disparities, as you'll see when you move to the next slide, show up also in the Institute of Medicine report. There was a report in 2002, and just in general, there are huge healthcare disparities, meaning differences in the way healthcare is provided to whites versus other groups, specifically African Americans and Hispanics. There's major differences in that care, and that difference in the access to care and clinical outcomes impacts things like smoking cessation and outcomes related to smoking. So what I'm saying is, if you take the average Caucasian person and you compare them to the average African American or Hispanic person, the African American or Hispanic person, on average, all things considered, including insurance, is going to receive poorer care. And so we know that these healthcare disparities exist. There's been tons of documentation about this, and this is a major problem and one that is trying to be addressed now on a systemic level, both in systems but also in clinical practice. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about clinical practice because, you know, I know most, if not all, people on this call are clinicians and dealing direct care with patients. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what things you can do when you want to be more attentive to cultural backgrounds as far as tobacco dependence. Okay. I'm just going to mention to you one other study, not related to smoking, but significant in that it really shows that this healthcare disparities exist. You know, this study that was done by Dr. Shulman in the late 1990s, what they did was they recorded videotapes, scripted videotapes of four actors, a African-American man, a white man, an African-American woman, and a white woman. All the scripts were the same. So they basically talked about symptoms, cardiac symptoms. And what was found was, although they were all talking about the cardiac symptoms, there were differences in the ways in which people referred. So white people were referred more often for important cardiac procedures based on the same script than were black people. And there was also an interaction effect for gender. So women were referred less than men. So there's clearly something going on here that's due to ethnicity and the way people look or the way that we consider them in terms of their skin color and their ethnic background. There's something happening here. And so it's important to consider that because, and interestingly, they replicated this study where they also looked at the ethnic background of the doctor, and it didn't change. So even when you had ethnic minority physicians, it was still happening, that same effect. So there's considerable bias, we assume or we hope, unintentional, but, you know, in all aspects of medical care. And that considerably affects the healthcare disparities. Okay, so if you move to the next slide, the issue here is, so what do we do? How do we change our relationship around smoking cessation? How can we be as a group? Because what I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk about such an important topic. I'm also delighted to hear that this is a call that a lot of people have called in for, which means you're interested in doing more around this. You have a desire to attend to this. You're probably many of you people who have learned a little bit about cultural issues, if not a lot. So what can we talk about? What are different things we can do? Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. One quote that I think gets at that issue I'll just continue on here. So one of the things I'm going to talk a little bit about is, if you move to the next slide, is introduce multicultural interviewing. So this is a technique or a group of questions, a way of being with clients, an interviewing style that can attend to cultural background. So I'm going to suggest some questions, and I'm just going to try to adapt it a little bit to smoking cessation as I've used it in my clinical practice and in the trainings that I do with healthcare providers in longer trainings about actually practicing these techniques. I'm going to give you some background of it first. If you move to the next line, you know, Kleinman was a psychiatrist and a medical anthropologist, and here I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of his background and his idea before we talk about the theory. Kleinman really talked about that there's a difference between disease and illness. So disease, in this case, sort of smoking dependence or tobacco dependence, we think about this as abnormality. Whereas illness is more what the patient experiences. So we may think of it as dependence. They may think of it as, well, you know, this is something that helps me feel less stressed and something that also makes me cough a lot or something that makes me feel chest pressure or something that I perceive to be related to poorer health. So that's really illness, or as Kleinman would talk about it. If you move to the next slide, you know, illness is affected by, as what we're talking about today, cultural background, social background, psychological factors, whereas disease is not. Smoking dependence is the same as a disease or as a issue, as a diagnosis. It's the same for everyone. How that smoking dependence manifests or is experienced by a particular person is very much impacted by their cultural background. So we're trying to understand people's cultural background because that is different from just tobacco dependence. We can easily say, oh, that person, you know, is a smoker. That's sort of the same, oh, how many packs a day or what, you know, so that's replicable. You know, everybody has a similar thing when they're smoking 5 packs a day. They have similar risk, et cetera. But how they experience that, the symptoms or the feelings related to smoking a pack a day or chewing, et cetera, how they experience information about oral cancer risks, et cetera, is different based on their cultural background. So that's what we're trying to attend to in asking these questions. Okay. If you move to the next slide, Kleinman would say that there's different explanatory models. How a patient expresses or explains their cigarette use or their tobacco use is, and the impact it has on their life is very much mediated or changed by their cultural background. And if we don't attend to it, the way that we think about that is that we're missing a very crucial piece of the puzzle. If we just assume everybody's the same, a smoker is a smoker, we're really not going to attend to some important things that may impact our counseling and impact our ability to motivate people, as we'll talk about shortly. So you as the clinician, whether you're a physician or you're a nurse practitioner or you're a respiratory therapist or you're an addictions counselor, you know, you'll gain really crucial information if you can interview in this way that I'm going to suggest. And it also gives you a better sense of rapport, which is, as we've talked about in the call, if you've attended my call, Motivational Interviewing, is really important in terms of any buy-in about quitting a behavior that someone is very attached to. Okay, so if you move to the next slide, as I said, you know, this is an ability to give you more ability to negotiate. If you can interview in a multicultural way and attend to a person's cultural background, even if someone is not amenable, they're not willing yet to quit smoking, they may be more willing based on your ability to connect to some of the reasons why they don't want to quit related to culture or their cultural background. Okay. Next slide. So this is the quote that I jumped ahead. I was so excited about telling you this quote that I almost said it before. It's more important to know what kind of patient has a disease than what kind of disease the patient has. In other words, it's really more important to think about what kind of smoker we're dealing with. What is their cultural norms, their community norms around smoking? Because once we understand that, we're in a better position to negotiate with them, to help them think about what we think is important, for example, risks related to smoking. So this quote by Sir William Osler, I think, really impacts my thinking around this, is that, you know, a smoker is not a smoker is not a smoker. People are different based on who they're smoking with, what their friends, family think about smoking, and that if we ask those crucial questions, we get at cultural beliefs that may greatly impact our success rates at helping people quit smoking. So let's move to the next slide. So what do we do? Well, Kleinman actually suggests some questions. So I'm going to give you what Kleinman said as general for healthcare. And this is helpful for whatever you're doing around working with anyone in which you feel there's a cultural difference, smoking or not. What do you think caused your problem? Why do you think it started when it did? What do you think your sickness does to you? How does it work? How severe is your sickness? Will it have a short or a long course? Next slide. What kind of treatment do you think you should receive? What are the most important results you hope to receive from this treatment? What are the chief problems your sickness has caused for you? What do you fear most about your sickness? To the next slide, and then there's a couple other centers that have talked a little bit about different models. This is from UMDNJ. And Dr. Lyke and colleagues, this ethnic acronym starts off with E, and this is getting at the explanatory model. What do you think the reason you might have these symptoms? What do friends or family others say about these symptoms? And these questions are very adaptable to smoking, right? What do friends, family, or others say about your smoking? Do you know of anyone else who has quit smoking or has tried to quit smoking in your community? What do you hear about smoking on the TV or radio stations? The next treatment. How do you smoke? What else do you do when you smoke? What are the things, how do you smoke? Tell me a little bit more about your smoking and how you think it may differ from other people as they smoke. Trying to get at some of those differences in sort of cultural norms. And then asking about healers, what other advice have you had about smoking? Who else has helped you? You might find that actually that you're getting a lot of information about things that people have tried, other influential people in their life. You know, I find a lot of the times that I think I'm the only psychologist working with someone. In fact, they have a whole bunch of psychologists in their community. They may be an imam, they may be a rabbi, they may be a santero, they may be a community leader. So finding that out could be really important, especially when you feel like you're getting nowhere with someone and you think that it may be due to differences in terms of cultural background or cultural belief. Okay. Next, you know, the intervention that you determined, really, it was someone who is culturally different. And when I say culturally different, a lot of people think I'm talking about a specific group. Culturally different for me is anyone who's culturally different from you. So if you're a person who comes from a Caucasian background in a rural setting and you're dealing with someone who's an urbanite, someone who's a city dweller from a different socioeconomic group, that could be a cultural difference. If you're someone who's straight and you're talking to someone who's gay, that could be a culturally difference. So if you're African American, you're talking to someone who's acculturated Latino from Ecuador, for example, that's culturally different. So anytime there's a cultural difference, there's more opportunity for a misalignment of how you think about smoking. And these techniques, these questions, are hoping to help you to bridge some of those gaps. Okay. When you're doing an intervention, as I said, when you're talking about smoking cessation, it's important to incorporate the person's ideas about smoking as it relates to their cultural background, as well as talking about the particular healers in their community. And by healers, I mean the people I was talking about before, community members, leaders, religious leaders, etc. Next slide. And then, as I said before, collaboration is really important, as I think I mentioned that. Okay. On to the next slide, enhancing your cultural communication skills. One of the things that, this is from the University of Michigan's center, and they recommend that when you start talking about cultural background, that you say something like, I would like to be a little bit more aware and respectful of your cultural background or your cultural beliefs. So if you think for a minute, you know, why would you ask something like that? Well, or say that kind of, why would you make a preamble to mention something like that or disclose that, be transparent? One of the reasons to do that, as you might be thinking here, is that when you start talking about cultural background, people sometimes get very sensitive, and people could become defensive. They may not understand what your motive is for asking questions about their cultural background. So asking making a statement like that is very clear that you're telling the patient, this is so I can help you better. This isn't because I have an ulterior motive. If you think about it, and someone comes in and they've had a bad experience with a physician or even in a store based on their cultural background and that they were misperceived or someone was or they're treated in a prejudicial fashion, they may think that that's your goal or that's your motive. And so saying something like this, as suggested by the University of Michigan, is a way of telling people that this is really to help you help them. Now, they may, of course, be unwilling to do that, and that's okay, so we'll just let it go. But this may be a way to help to show someone that your goal is really to help them figure things out and to be the best healthcare provider you can. Some other questions that the University of Michigan suggests that I think are really helpful. What are the languages you speak at home and languages that you speak? And this is very crucial. Tell me about beliefs, and you can say this related to smoking, I often do. Can you tell me about beliefs and practices around smoking or other special events around smoking that you feel it's important I should know about? You could gain some really important information. There may be some things going on culturally related to smoking that are really important that you know about that may be crucial in helping them if they decide to smoke in terms of avoiding high-risk situations and how to deal with those situations in a culturally appropriate way. Next slide. How often did you see a healthcare provider before you arrived in the U.S.? One of the things I could ask that I could recommend that you can ask about smoking that I think is very helpful is to say, you know, what information did you get about smoking cessation before? This is, of course, for someone who's moved here, before you moved to the United States. What are the differences around smoking that you've perceived between here and the United States? They may tell you important information about access, about cultural norms, that you can help them think through. Because it's one thing, certainly, to give education about smoking cessation, and I'm sure everybody, or most people on this call, are doing that in a very excellent fashion. It's another thing to take it to the next level, which I think most of you are interested in, and think about, once that education has been given, what are the things that may contribute to unsuccessful implementation of your plan? And how can you protect your patient against relapse in terms of smoking? A lot of that relapse could certainly be due to things that are going on a cultural level that if you can get a better handle on, you may be able to help. Okay. We'll move on to the next slide. What I wanted to do, as I said, I wanted to really, I've been trying during this call to explain how these techniques are appropriate and applicable in smoking cessation. I wanted to go a little bit further and coalesce this whole talk and these ideas with the 5R model, talking about relevance, risk, rewards, roadblocks, and repetition, which is a model that we think about in terms of smoking cessation, and tell you about some questions that I asked that I think may be helpful to you to get at some of the cultural issues. First of all, relevance. As I said before, it's important to find out about cultural norms about smoking. So we're on the next slide, entitled Relevance. What do your friends, family, religious leaders, or coworkers think about smoking? What do people in your neighborhood or where you're from think about smoking? And then you move to the next slide on risks. These questions are also related in some way to motivational enhancement. If you've heard my talk on motivational interviewing, we're trying to find out what motivates people, because we know that if they're highly motivated, they're going to have much more success in terms of quitting smoking. And you see my website below. You can certainly check out my website, and there's more information about motivational interviewing and some slides that go into greater detail. So in terms of risks, and this, again, is connected to motivation, what risks are culturally relevant? What do you think of the health risks that we discussed? If you're talking about health risks, and those health risks are not relevant, right? They may not be relevant to a particular cultural group or a particular age group, then we have to find risks that are. So what do you think about health risks? And if they say, well, doesn't really affect me, then we have to do a little deeper digging in terms of what are the risks there that are relevant to them around smoking. How important are these risks to your family, friends, community in which you live? This will give us some information about what kind of resistance this person may be receiving in their community around smoking cessation. And then if that resistance is there, our job is more about helping them deal with that if they choose to quit smoking, rather than a particular recommendation around the method of quitting smoking. Next slide. Rewards. What are the positive benefits for them if they decide to quit? So who would be most helpful about you quitting and why? Again, these questions are specific to find out about a little bit about how culture may or may not be impacting, although you may get some valuable social and psychological information there as well with this question. And then next, roadblocks. You want to figure out what are the barriers that may be most significant in terms of preventing the person from quitting. So what are the things that make it difficult for you to quit? What are some of the important values you have about smoking or not smoking? Who would be upset if you quit and why? Again, we want to find out what are some of the cultural norms, some of the familial norms around smoking to see what we're up against here. And then repetition. So again, you know, we're trying to revisit any of the steps if there's any difficulty due to some cultural background. And it's also an opportunity to really affirm and normalize these difficulties. You're going to go a long way with someone who is of a different cultural background if you say something like, I can imagine how hard it is for you to quit, given the fact that everyone you're living around is smoking, or given the fact that smoking is part of the what you see happening in your neighborhood day to day. That's going to get you way closer to a relationship with someone when you're talking about quitting smoking or sticking to their plan about smoking cessation. All right, so we'll move to the next slide here. So just a few, come back and give a little summary of what we talked about. You know, this multicultural interviewing, some of the questions I recommended, by far, they're not the most exhaustive questions. There's tons that you can add to them. I just wanted to give you a sense of, when we think about multicultural interviewing, what's out there in the literature, what's out there in practice, what do I use? It's a real tool for you to think about how culture interacts with tobacco use, and it can be useful for everyone. So, this is certainly a tool that could be helpful with every smoker. But with people that you're seeing more than once, and certainly with people who are culturally different from you, it's really essential. Time is an issue, as I know, in working in primary care for many years. And, you know, what I recommend is that you have a couple questions. So what do people that who are living around you or in your neighborhood or in your family think about this, think about smoking? What of the risks we talk about, which do you think make sense to you, or which impact do you, if any? So, and also, I guess I said, you know, back to the Yoda quote, you know, name must be our fear before banish it we can. You know, this is difficult stuff. It's hard, as it is hard to just talk about these topics. You know, when I do, as I said, the trainings for different groups, I find that it takes a little bit for the group to warm up to even just being honest and talking about some of their fears. And I'm interested to hear some of the questions that we have today about that. So what's difficult about this? Well, one of the things that's difficult is just doing what you're doing, right, which is taking the first step, asking the first question, trying to bridge a gap with a person that you feel may be culturally different by being respectful and questioning and curious about them. Next slide. Just a couple, I just want to bring up an issue. There's no way that I'm going to be able to, hopefully I'll be able to even, you know, just talk about it and finish the ideas in the 5 minutes that I have remaining for this call before we go to some questions. I just want to talk about, again, back to the issue of prejudice and racism. You know, there's a lot of research and talk about racism and prejudice. One of the issues that we don't talk a lot about is privilege. So I just want to talk a little bit about that. If you move to the next slide, you know, privilege is an idea that there's certain members of our society, based on gender, based on skin color, et cetera, that have certain privileges that other groups don't have, and that privilege is more subtle than racism or prejudice. You can be from a particular group and have more power or ability to obtain health care, as we saw. And that privilege can be invisible. In other words, it's not really seen. It's hard to prove. It can be taken for granted if you have the privilege. I'll give you an example. What's one privilege that, you know, almost probably everyone on this call has? Well, if you think about it, 99% of us, if not all of us, have the privilege of education. And that impacts our ability to be more financially successful, to have a more stable home life, et cetera, as a whole. We also have access to this call, which means that we have access probably to technology. These are all privileges, and that when you think about that on an ethnic level or a skin color level or a gender level or a sexual orientation level or a socioeconomic level, it vastly impacts people's ability to do things like quit smoking. It can also be something that can be a hook to quit smoking. So we really want to think about that and help identify that and understand and help people overcome barriers. If it's hard to get to a clinic, if it's hard to think about ways to have substitute behaviors for smoking, et cetera. If it's hard to figure out, you know, one of the things I like to tell my clients, well, you know, it's helpful to begin to exercise more when you're trying to quit smoking. However, not everybody has the socioeconomic means to do so. So being thoughtful and respectful about that is important. Move to the next slide. You know, skin color, we find, is one of the major, as we saw in that study, factors that impacts people's ability to gain health care, but also overall their experiences, and that there's many other variables, and I'm by no means is this a list that enumerates all of them, but, you know, they're among the most, you know, the more powerful ones are certainly gender, age, sexual orientation, economic status, disability status, religion, immigration status, language ability. These are all things that can give people or take away privileges. So, you know, one of the reasons I have this up there is, you know, in a longer training, I actually practice with people when we have scenarios about this. If you move to the next slide, you know, these issues come up. They come up in medical care in many situations, and certainly in tobacco dependence. And one of the things that I just recommend is to watch our defensiveness. Most of the time, if an issue comes up around a patient or a client feeling like there's prejudice in the situation or in the interaction or in the clinic, it's usually a reaction of us as the care provider to become very defensive. So one of the things I suggest is to not do that, to not give reasons why you're not racist or you're not prejudiced, but to really focus on the person's experience, ask them what they've experienced, and to validate it, to show them that you understand how difficult it must be to be experiencing what they've experienced. So rather than to fight back, even in a nice way, or disagree, this is about really identifying that certainly privilege exists and prejudice exists, and how tough it is for the person, how feeling empathy for how difficult it must be to be experiencing it, rather than trying to disagree that it's not happening in that particular moment. So often when I do a training, you know, people ask me, well, what can I do now? Well, certainly, if you move to the next slide, you know, understanding privilege is a good start. And, you know, thinking about developing this awareness, you can really, it'll help you to do many things. One of them is to be more attentive to when these issues come up and hopefully be less defensive. And hopefully really break down those barriers to care on an individual level. And on the next slide, I'm hoping that this talk is just something to give you a few skills, but also to increase whet your appetite for ways that you can be more respectful, and also just to think about how to have more curiosity about how culture interacts with your relationship with tobacco use, with your patient's relationship with tobacco use. So I've given you some suggestions about how you can interview and ask questions about that, to think about how culture impacts tobacco use, and then that hopefully will set you up to be able to negotiate these beliefs in a way that will increase the likelihood that someone who's culturally different from you may be more willing to entertain the idea of quitting smoking. So we're moving on now to some questions, but before we do that, I just want to turn this call over to a very close colleague of mine, Pat Bax, who's the marketing coordinator for the Quit Line, the New York State Quit Line. And Pat has been extremely influential in putting together these calls and a great colleague in terms of developing content that's useful to the community in smoking cessation. So thank you, Pat, and I'll turn it over to you to talk a little bit about this great resource we have in the New York State Quit Line.
Thank you, Dr. Fader, and thanks for that excellent presentation. It really, I believe, will help us to rethink and really change some of the behavior and how we assist smokers to help them to quit. So I really appreciate all your information. On behalf of the New York State Smokers Quit Line team, I want to thank all of you who are on the call today for assisting your patients and your clients in 2010 to help them become tobacco free. And as we begin 2011, let's make this be the year that we celebrate even more tobacco users quitting for good. For anyone who is listening for the first time on our call today, I do invite you to explore our website at nysmokefree.com. As you'll see, we have recently had a facelift to our website. Or you can call us at 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487 to learn more about our services. And these services include a free starter kit of patches or gum to eligible New York State residents, our online free smoke-free community called Breathe, a wide array of cessation resources and information. And related specifically to our call today, I want to highlight our Spanish version of our website, which you can access on the left side of our homepage. And in addition, we have select fact sheets that are available in Chinese, in simple and traditional Korean, Vietnamese, and Russian. Our focus at the Quit Line for 2011 is really to improve the efficiencies with our provider referral program. At this synergistic time with the electronic health records, health integration technology, health reform, and the pending implementation of the Joint Commission standards, tobacco standards. And all of you who are listening today are our customers, and we welcome your suggestions and your feedback. So I invite you to contact your respective cessation centers, and the list is posted on our website, so you can identify the cessation center that works within your county, or email me directly at patricia.bax@roswellpark.org if you have comments that you would like to share as we move forward with our provider referral program and making some changes. So at this time, time, I'd like to turn the call back to Elizabeth, and we will open it up for questions.
Okay. If you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay. First in queue, we have Nicole Park. Nicole, your line is open.
Thank you to Pat. I'd like to know, have we received the numbers of call-ins for 2010?
Hi, we are still calculating that information, and we will be actually putting out a 2010 annual report similar to previous reports, and that will be available as soon as all the data is collected and processed. So that will be posted on our website for your use.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next in queue, we have Lori Vokes. Lori, your line is open.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the chance to be on this call today. The question I have, I know that it was mentioned that there is kind of limited information about some of the multicultural interview skills, but is there any information showing that that does, in fact, lead to a higher success rate for tobacco use? Because it would be great to have that information.
Yeah, you know, there's information regarding, that's a wonderful question. And so, you know, there's information that says that this type of interviewing impacts healthcare in general. As far as smoking cessation rates, I'm not sure there's been a study yet that's documented this. What we know is that this type of interviewing impacts and attentiveness to this type of interviewing impacts overall healthcare outcome, impacts provider relationships, which is really the crucial aspect of this. But, you know, there's more. We recently did a study that we haven't published yet about looking at teaching people this technique and the impact it has also on clinicians. And so we're figuring out that study, and we found that, you know, it does impact also clinician behavior in general, just to use this technique. But, you know, that's a good question. I'm not aware. To this date, I don't know of a particular study that has documented the actual impact on smoking cessation. And that's, I mean, you raise a good point. That's really where we should be going in terms of research, is to actually start to look at, which of these techniques are going to be most important specifically in terms of impacting outcomes with different populations about smoking cessation. Hopefully there'll be, you know, from this call and others like it, there'll be more grants and opportunities to do that type of important research.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Okay. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, we have Nicole Park in queue again. Nicole, your line is open.
Thank you. I had another question in regards to physicians being open to this type of training. I contact with patients, and what I hear back from them about the conversation with the physician is oftentimes in conflict with what I'm talking with them about. So I wanted to know how open physicians have been to this type of training, or if it's even been offered.
That's a wonderful question. And, you know, before I even answer that, I'll just say, Nicole, that, one of the things that Nicole is demonstrating is a lot of courage, because people don't really ask a lot of questions about this. And I see that, to answer your question specifically, what Nicole's demonstrating is courage around a topic that's very sensitive. You know, the physicians, but just in healthcare in general, we like to have things very airtight, right? We like to leave with our notes in check. And we like to leave with everything sort of clear, that we've counseled about smoking cessation and the person's going to quit. And often when culture comes up, it's just not that simple. Cultural background is one of the very complex aspects to how someone makes a decision around smoking cessation. So I find that, you know, with physicians, but other healthcare providers as well, there is some resistance to this topic. The other issue is that what people sometimes think about or say is, well, you know, look, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse, I'm a respiratory therapist, I see all patients as the same. So it doesn't matter what their skin color is or what their ethnic background is. I see them the same. And, you know, while I think that's true in spirit, it's not really necessarily true in practice, as we saw from some of the studies I talked about. And so one of the resistances that you find in doing training around this is that usually I have to work towards getting over in the early part of a training is helping people to realize that this is not something that's necessarily they're perpetuating on purpose. It's not something that, you know, I went into healthcare to be prejudiced or to overlook cultural differences. It's just something that really is part of the system in some ways, as we saw in that study that I was talking about, the Shulman study. So you're absolutely right. There is certain resistance. I don't think it's entirely exclusive, though, to physicians. I find it, you know, in training psychologists. I find it in training social workers. I certainly find it in training various different healthcare providers. And I think it's definitely sometimes related to the way training occurs in the healthcare professions, and it's a very good point. So, you know, one of the things that we try to do in people in my field who are doing training around being attentive to cultural backgrounds is to make the trainings also experiential and to help people to really think about themselves before they start thinking about other people, because it really starts with having, being self-examined and understanding where we all make assumptions about people and we all have different ideas that are and stereotypes that are incorrect. So, you know, one of the things I find to be effective in working with physicians and other groups who have resistance is really to show them that I'm not here to criticize them or to point out that they're doing something wrong. I'm here to help them think about, if they're willing to, their ability to even be better at what they do, as you clearly find it important in your work, which is again, impressive. And I hope that, you know, you continue to be a leader in asking the questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next in queue, we have Sue Crittenland. Sue, your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. We have a question about dealing with teenagers. So it's not really a cultural group, although it could be, but any suggestions that you have for working with that population?
Oh, absolutely. In my mind, teenagers are definitely a cultural group. You know, it's unbelievable. And my, you know, 9-year-old is already tweening out. And so I'm already thinking about the ways that I can help protect her from tobacco use. Let's see here. My main thought about teenagers is, first of all, I think of them as definitely being a cultural group. The main factor in the culture of adolescence is time. Adolescents have a different perception and abstraction about thinking about how time and consequence works. What I mean by that? You know, when you think about someone who's in their 40s or 50s, and you talk about emphysema or lung cancer, that they can imagine. An adolescent cannot imagine these kind of consequences. So when we think about the consequences for adolescents or talking about smoking cessation, it's much more about self-esteem, it's much more about athletics, it's much more about looking cool or people they associate with as cool, and helping to see what discrepancies there are there in terms of smoking and those particular behaviors. So what I try to do with adolescents around some of these issues, and again, this sort of relates to motivational interviewing, is to help them to think about what's important to them. Adolescents, my joke is, you know, adolescents don't think about what's going to happen in the next 5 years. They think about what's going to happen in the next 5 Twitter updates or Facebook updates. So, you know, thinking about cultural norms for their group, how, in fact, there may be some differences, and there may not, about what they want to do, and then helping them to think about, to abstract a little bit more about the future. So one of the questions I ask adolescents is, rather than saying, well, what's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen about your smoking in 5 years, 10 years? It's very hard to do that. What I'll ask an adolescent is, okay, let's say, think about yourself smoking. Let's say this is a movie about your life, and you're watching this movie, and how would smoking turn out in the movie? There you may be able to get them to talk about some things that they can't really think about because it's hard to imagine. But if you can be creative with an adolescent, creativity is key, and, you know, self-deprecation is key, you know, making fun of yourself. The first thing I joke about with adolescents is, you know, how boring I am, right, because that helps you to form a relationship with them. So anyway, so what I think about with adolescents is really thinking about how some of the risks we talk about as smoking cessation are not applicable, and how can I think about things like athletics, cost, social embarrassment, all these things that may be more important to them.
Thank you.
No, thank you. That's a great question.
Okay. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, we have Nancy Jenks in queue. Nancy, your line is open.
Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Fader. This has been a great conference call. I loved your last description of the culture of teenagers, and that was very helpful for me in terms of putting some of what you've discussed in context. And I'm wondering if you could take one other example of another culture, and I don't really care which one it is, and give maybe another kind of some ideas, as you did with this one, of how to approach the patient dependent on their cultural background.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a couple examples. You know, one of the things that that a different culture, right, is sort of working with athletes. And you know, one of the things that I found in working with athletes is sort of the culture of chew, and you know, and oral tobacco, not smokeless tobacco, rather. So you know, one of the skills that I've worked with athletes about that is how to deal with the social norms. I spend much less time on, you know, I certainly spend some time on substitute and chewing gum and different things that they could do, and if they're, you know, depending on what they're, if they're doing an NRT or if they're doing a Nicorette or whatever, you know, is to help them think about, you know, how to do that, but also how to deal with people in their community when they're getting razzed or, you know, people are teasing them about that. And I go as far as role-playing with people about how to deal with a fellow athlete. So that's one example. I'll give you another example. I worked with a group of migrant workers, for example, from Mexico. And one of the things that people, that this particular group, it may not be true, it certainly is not true, of all groups, but this group, one of the things that one of the big ways of relieving stress was to smoke cigarettes after work. And so, you know, I found that it was really important to ask a lot of the questions about that. Now, I'm still not sure, as I said before, whether, you know, if it's more of a stereotype, but I'm certain it was true in that community that I'm talking about. And so working with that particular person to show them that I understand that this is something that's hard because it's a group event. And also, and so, you know, really using my skills of empathizing with that, but also giving the person tools about what would be culturally appropriate ways to replace that behavior. It's not, you know, in that group, if this person went back and was, you know, had a patch, people would have made fun of them, right? So it's really thinking about how they can use a behavior or which nicotine replacement or which kind of way of dealing with smoking cessation is going to be most helpful and efficacious or synthesized best with that particular community.
Okay, Dr. Fader, this is Annie Beigel. I think we need, that will have to be the last question. We're at the top of the hour. So on behalf of the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, the New York State Smokers Quit Line, and, of course, the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, we want to thank you for this excellent presentation today. And I would like to thank all of the participants on the call today. I know we have probably well over 500 participants listening in on today's call. So thank you for your interest in this topic and participating today. And please mark your calendars. Our next conference call will be on March 2nd, and the topic's going to be the nurse's role in treating tobacco use in the primary care setting. Our featured speaker will be Dr. Janie Heath. So this will bring us to the end of today's call. Thanks to all of you for participating. Thank you, Dr. Fader, and I wish you all a happy new year. Thank you.